You're listening to Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin. Happy January 6th.
Good morning. Happy January 6th to you.
You can feel the town exhaling a little bit. A lot of the tourists are gone. You can actually get to where you need to get to a little bit faster. But it's a good morning to sit and join us. We're going to spend our morning. We're going to start by speaking with Fabrice Coise. He's the founder of Scents of Woods, a Wasatch-back fragrance company.
And then we'll chat with, we'll get Richard Hodges back from White Pine Touring, not to talk about the wax colors, but about all the activities they have going on this season. And then we'll finish our show with Emerson Cruz Oliveira of the Bridge Cafe and other businesses.
I don't know about you, Kevin, but I'm going to ask him what all those wax colors mean. I've never understood that. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Scents of Wood is a fragrance manufacturer located right here in the Wasatch Back. I was fortunate enough to meet the founder, Fabrice Coise, in typical Park City fashion at the Summit House as we shared a cup of coffee. And I thought he'd be an interesting guest to join us this morning. Fabrice, thanks for joining us and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fabrice, let's share a bit about your background. How did you get into the fragrance business? What's your history?
I've always been in the fragrance business, and usually people ask me, was that a family business that was bestowed upon you? And that's not the case. I was hired by L'Oreal right out of college, and as they do it, I had an HR interview. And I was, I sat with for 45 minutes with a woman that I don't know her name. I don't know where to find her. It was before LinkedIn. And there's no way, she's probably 80 by now and retired, hopefully still alive somewhere in the south of France. She lives in Saint-Tropez. That's what I imagine. And so I don't know where to find her, but in 45 minutes, she decided my entire career. She asked me a few questions and then she said, "You? Fragrance." And she could have said, "You skincare," or "You hair," or "You makeup." But no, she said, "You fragrance." And then they put me on fragrance development on their biggest brand, actually, on Lancôme. And I worked there for 7 years. And then I stayed in fragrance my entire life.
Let's unpack that just a little bit. What, you know, for 7 years on an established fragrance, what did you...
Well, so on big brands like this, fragrance launches are as big money-wise as new movies, right? It's like tens and tens of millions of dollars of advertising worldwide. It's launched in every country. It's a huge deal. And fragrance development itself is usually 3 years long. So I worked on two fragrances back to back, and that took 7 years.
Wow.
Because it's like there's so much market research, so much money involved that they really want to launch something that is going to be satisfying to a customer in Germany, a customer in China, and a customer in South America at the same time. So it requires a lot of research for that.
Yeah, I want to probe a little bit about that because I have this vision of an olfactory version of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, which is that there's these rooms where you have multiple different things that you're trying to mix together and see if they create an interesting fragrance as the first step. Is that kind of what you guys
do? So what you're describing is what I'm doing right now.
What you're describing
is the workshop that I have here in the Wasatch in Midway and the work that I do every day. What I was talking about before is the work that a multinational company like L'Oreal does in order to launch the next bestseller, the next number one fragrance in the world, you know, which is a very different take on the business.
And so what are the, again, staying with L'Oreal, because I really want to get to your Willy Wonka existence, but staying with L'Oreal for the moment, how does that process, run us through that process. Obviously, someone comes in, a technical
person. You have a team of marketers, right. And I was one of them. And what you do is you orchestrate a creative project around a central idea. So you come up with a concept for the next fragrance, and then you brief a whole bunch of different artists and different designers, bottle, packaging, scent, advertising, and then you try to make sure that all of the, you act as a conductor, if you will. You try to make sure that all those elements of the mix fit perfectly together until naming is one of them, until the launch happens. And the most interesting part of all of this for me was interacting with the perfumers. So as far as the scent is concerned, you organize, and for actually every single element, you organize a pitch between different perfumers, between different designers, between different, whatever it may be. And then somebody wins, and then you work with that person until the project is perfectly defined and you're ready to launch.
Is it stressful?
Extremely.
Or was that time shift? Yeah.
It's very stressful. It's very stressful because you're working for a huge company and there's a lot of money at play. And I was at the bottom of the ladder back then. That was the beginning of my career.
Yeah.
So, it was quite stressful. I would never go back to corporate fragrance. I don't think I would ever do this. I'm sure I will never do this. but it's the best way to start. And
right.
The reason why it's the best way to start your career, fragrance is one of those fields where people who work in fragrance have always been in fragrance. So no one goes into fragrance mid-career mm-hmm. because it requires too much. It's too weird a topic, that too strange a type of knowledge that you can actually gain it midway through your career. So everybody who is in fragrance has started in fragrance and no one leaves because it's really, really cool. It's a very exciting business to be in. So it's kind of like this sub-segment of beauty where people just like keep to themselves and do their thing. And starting at the biggest company in the world in beauty is the best way to do it, right? So after L'Oréal, I went into an agency, communication and strategy agency, specialized in perfume. And I worked for them for 16 years in New York. And then I opened the office in Geneva and then in Los Angeles. And that fell in place with my mountain life. So I opened the office in Geneva so I could live in the Alps near Chamonix. And then I moved from Chamonix to Park City, and I opened the agency in Los Angeles so I could commute back and forth between Park City and Los Angeles, because behind fragrance, skiing is my passion, right? And then I worked for this agency for 16 years. Then I launched my first brand in 2014. Which sold in 2018 to the Spanish L'Oréal. And then I started Sense of Wood in 2020, and here we are.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. So now are your plans to sell Sense of Woods, or is this your...
We'll see. My plan is to grow Sense of Wood, and then we'll see if... Yeah, I don't want to sell it. If I do sell it, I don't want to sell. I sold the other one, the first one, way too early.
Okay.
So I don't want to do the same mistake. So if I do grow and sell Sense of Wood, it won't be before 5 to 7 years from now, and we'll see where we're at that time.
And at Sense of Woods, how many different fragrances do you have there?
So we have created over the past 4 years, we've created 43 fragrances, which is a huge amount of fragrances. The reason for this is that I launched this business to be completely a direct-to-consumer business. My previous brand was a department store business. So it was called EB Florals. It was all about flowers, about floral notes. And it was sold at Saks and Bergdorf and Le Bon Marché in France and Selfridges in London and so on. Right? So it was a luxury department store business. And I was traveling all the time from one Saks to another. When we sold, we were in 22 different Saks stores, from Honolulu to Toronto to Miami to San Francisco. I was always on planes. And when you go into a department store, as a brand owner, you need to speak to the store manager and the PR manager and the marketing manager and the fragrance manager, and you just need to spend so much time in order to make your brand grow. And so I promised myself that I would spend more time with my family and more time skiing with my next brand, and I would do it direct to consumers. I would be able to ship from Park City or from wherever my workshop would be. It ended up being in Midway, and spend more time on the mountain with my kids. And so I did that, and that's the reason why we have so many fragrances, because from a business perspective, when you are a department store business, you always live for the next department, for the next door that you're going to open, because that represents an opening order, and that's a lot of cash, and that cash flow allows you to keep moving. When you do a direct-to-consumer business, you don't have openings like this. Every single order is $240 and that's it, right? So I needed to come up with a way of having a recurring monthly income that would be kind of similar to opening new doors, but with the digital tool. And that's how I came up with this idea of a subscription. And because we had the subscription, we needed to have a new fragrance every month. Now we're doing it seasonally, so it's four fragrances a year, but to put my brand on the map, I decided for the first 3 years to do it every month, hence the number of fragrances.
I want to ask a question that at least half our audience is already going to know the answer to. What are the fragrances used for?
So those are personal fragrances.
Personal fragrances.
Yeah,
you just apply it to your.
You put it on your clothes, or you put it on your skin, or you, you know. I tend to use fragrance myself as in a bit of a unconventional way because it's a fragrance is an art form, and not only to me. I mean, people really like fragrance. Look at it as an art form. It's not just a product in a bottle. It's really it's really a piece of art. And so I interact with my fragrances maybe in a different way than most people do. I'm always carrying blotters. I have some in my bag right now. I'm always carrying blotters that have a scent or another on them, and I keep smelling them throughout the day. I spray everything in my house, my books, my furniture, the lampshades, whatever, just so that I'm surrounded by scents, and I keep evolving them in my mind, and then I can have an informed interaction with the perfumers to bring them to the moment where I think we can launch them, you know.
Now, as an expert on fragrances, do you have specific fragrances that help you feel a certain way, give you whether it's a confidence or if you're going into a sales meeting, let's say? Is there a fragrance that gives you a power?
That is very interesting that you ask this question. I was hired in last year, 2024, by a big fragrance brand called Scentbird. They have a subscription service across all fragrance brands that exist, and they hired me as a creative director to design two neuroscents. Well, to design two scents in collaboration with Scents of Wood, and I proposed to them this idea of neuroscents. And neuroscents are scents that are exclusively based on ingredients that have been proven to have a neurological benefit. And it's a study that has been done by the fragrance house that I work with for decades. It started with aromatherapy and then it became more scientific, and they started putting like those little things on people's head and measuring their reaction and then doing like brain scans and just having them smell one single ingredient and then the code and then the fragrance and then just trying to see how it impacts their mood. And so I proposed to them to do two fragrances, one about serenity and calm, and the other one about self-empowerment and self-confidence, to your point about the meeting. Exactly. And two fragrances were born out of this. One is called Calm in Cedar, and the other one is called Strength in Santal. And judging by the reviews and the comments from the customers, they actually do work. So yes, the answer is yes.
Your question is
yes, you can do that. It's a nascent and new field within the whole field of fragrance, you know, neuroscent, but something that I find very interesting, and I'm really happy that I worked on this with Scentbird. So yeah,
it adds a science to the art side of what you were discussing
earlier.
It does.
That's true. Yeah. Usually there's this tension between art and commerce. In that case, it's between art and science, which is cool.
Yeah,
I want to go back. What was the number of scents that you have?
43.
43.
Yeah.
Share with us a little bit about what are the kinds of ingredients that go into making that many different scents.
So Scents of Wood is a brand. My idea behind the brand was to anchor it in olfaction. So I wanted the brand's concept to be entirely revolving around one kind of notes, and that kind of notes I chose to be wood notes for obvious reasons. We're surrounded by I live here with like you guys in Park City. We're surrounded by trees and forests and those magnificent landscapes, and it's very inspiring on a daily basis to get out of my house and drive to my workshop and see all those trees and come up with ideas. You know, in the summer I use Guardsman's Pass and it's just wonderful. So I wanted every single fragrance that we would ever produce to be articulated around woody notes. Now that might seem narrow to you, but there's actually an infinite number of kind of trees in the world. I could do this every month for 100 years and I would still come up with ideas. And not only because there are so many trees, but also you can extract, and there are various ways of doing it. We're not going to go into the details of this, but you can extract a scent from a bark, from a fruit, from a leaf. And so there are different ways you can make a tree resonate olfactively, but also some trees don't have any scent, and you can imagine what that tree would smell like if it has a scent. Like, for instance, we have a scent, we have a fragrance that is called Ebony in Oak, and it's the smell of ebony if MOD had the smell, which it doesn't. But we just imagine it based on all the imagination around ebony that we all have, all the seeing those ships in the 18th century bringing it back from the tropics, and the commerce of luxury woods and all those things, right? So you can create fragrances forever around woods, and so I chose that idea of woody notes, and then I came up with this idea of aging the alcohol that we use in wooden barrels. So I purchased wooden barrels from around the world, and we aged our alcohol. Fragrance is the dilution of essential oils into alcohol. We age the alcohol, then we dilute the oils into the aged alcohol, and we add even more woodiness to our fragrances and even more emotion that way. And that's how the brand was born.
I'm fascinated. I don't know about you, but this is something completely new to me. So you're going to leave here. You're going to go to your shop.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? What's task one on a Monday morning?
So this is the first day of the new year. Yeah. So we have some business things that we need to take care of, such as finishing the inventory, making sure that our orders of components are all in place, looking at all the orders that we received during the season and do all the analytics about this. So this is what I'm going to be doing while my team is doing the usual filling, assembling, packing, shipping to everywhere where we ship to.
Yeah. I want to talk a little more about how, following up on Kevin's question, how you are going to create the fragrance for the next quarter. You know, you're going to have some new fragrances under their subscription. Yeah. Tell us about the process in the laboratory that I was asking.
So the fragrance for the next quarter is already created. It's been done for a few months now. I'm right now currently working on the fragrance for 3 quarters from now. And the way I do this is I choose a perfumer. And so I've been working on this brand. I've been working with 11 perfumers to date. I choose a perfumer and I talk to them about their personal forest. So the personal forest is the briefing process that I invented for Sense of Wood. I believe that every single fragrance brand should have its own briefing process. And what I invented for Sense of Wood was this idea of personal forest. If you close your eyes and you imagine all the forests and the trees and the wooden objects that make you who you are, everybody has a personal forest. Everybody has a tree that they remember where they built their first tree house, or a forest where they were walking with their grandmother, or something, or a tree that they planted yesterday, but it doesn't have to be like in your childhood. And so I get the perfumer talking, and they tell me about their personal forest, and at some point I stop them and on one memory that I really like, and I say, tell me more about this one. And so they talk, and we ask more questions, and then I say, well, let's do a fragrance about that. And what that results in is a fragrance that is not only anchored in this idea of woody notes and the barrel and all this, but also anchored in the emotions and the personal story of the perfumer. And you can smell that in the fragrance. You can smell that there's something really emotional in the sense that we do because of that briefing process. So that's what I'm going to be doing soon for the fragrance that is going to come out next season, actually.
And then, okay, let's iterate that. So you have this conversation with the perfumer. Then I assume you get some sample. The perfumer will make some experiments for you.
So the perfumers are obviously not based in Park City.
Right.
Perfumers are a very select small group of people, fine fragrance perfumers. There's 120 of them in the world, right? So there's less... There's less perfumers than presidents of country. It's really astronauts or whatever.
Just club, yes.
It's a super select group of people. And they're all based either in New York, in Paris, or in Geneva. And that's it, right? And you can sprinkle a few independent perfumers that are here and there, but that this is where they are. So I work usually with perfumers in Paris and in New York for this. I will go through the brief following the process that I detail. And then 3 months later, 2 months later, sometimes very fast, a few weeks later, they will send me little vials, little lab vials for me to smell. And that's when the process starts. I smell, I give them my feedback, and we meet or we do this long distance, and we keep working on the project until we have a scent that we feel is done. And then we choose the barrel, and then we go into production. So
how many iterations does that typically take?
So it can be anywhere between none and... I don't like modifications much. I try to keep myself at bay. I really want to stay as close as possible to the original creation. When I was working at Lancôme, going back to the beginning of our conversation, we ended up launching on that huge blockbuster of a fragrance version 396D of the original fragrance. I will never do that again. This is absolutely madness. I don't do any consumer research. I don't do any of anything that would justify changing endlessly a fragrance. difference. So to answer your question, between 0 and 3 to 4.
And I take it that you use a one-person focus group to test your products.
Yeah, that's
me. That would be you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Me and the perfumer. And there are a few of the fragrances that we have launched that I'm not a big fan of, but I force myself sometimes to listen to the perfumer. We get to a point where I'm like, okay, usually they come back with an idea and I immediately say yes or no, right? And if I say yes, then we go into a little bit of work or we launch it as such. And then we just go into the choice of the barrel and so on. But if I decided that we're going to not go for it, sometimes the perfumer is like, you're missing out. This is really good. I love this idea. You should rethink that. And what I usually do then is I end up saying, okay, fine, let's do it. Finish it the way you think it should be finished. I'm going to kind of stay out of it, and I'm going to launch a fragrance that I do not like. And I do this intentionally because I don't want my brand to be a reflection of only my taste. I want it to be a little bit more of a committee, if you will, of informed minds. So
now you have your fragrance, and now you have to have a name, a label, and a bottle shape.
So I came up with a name. That's correct. I came up with a name principle, which is always X in Y, and X is the main note, and Y is the name of the tech kind of barrel.
Like ebony and oak. Instance,
ebony in oak is an ebony fragrance in an oak barrel. Vetiver in chestnut is a vetiver fragrance in a chestnut barrel, and so on, right? So that the name is easy, and it doesn't have to be trademarked because it's so unique and so specific that I don't have to worry about legal implications. I'm the only brand in the world that has this name. In terms of bottle, we designed a bottle that we always use. It's always the same bottle. However, we allow our customers to choose to customize it. So the bottle is inspired by Japanese ceramics. I love Japan, and then Japan played a big role in the creation of this brand from a design perspective. So it's inspired by Japanese ceramics. It's an opaque bottle, and you can choose between various colors. And then the cap, which is an abstraction of a tree, is you can choose also between different rendering. You can black and gold. So when you order it online, you can customize your bottle a little bit. And the final result of that bottle is like it actually looks like it's quite, everybody loves this bottle. It's like it looks like a heart.
Yeah.
Which never was my intention. I just wanted to have like this Japanese ceramic inspiration and then the abstraction of a tree on top. But it does look like a heart, and everybody has been telling me this for 4 years. So now I call it the heart of the forest, and it's perfectly fine.
So that other people can see what we're looking at on right here, since this is radio. What's the website that they can go to right now while they're listening? And
senseofwood.com. And senseofwood spelled S-C-E-N-T-S of wood. So senseofwood.com.
And for those, we've talked a little bit about your economic model. Explain to us your subscription model and how does it work?
So the subscription model is very simple. You subscribe to Sense of Wood and receive a 10 ml, so a travel size, of a brand new fragrance every season. Mm-hmm. And it costs $40 plus shipping every season, so it's very affordable. And you are the first people in the world to try this fragrance because we send it to our subscribers before making it available to the rest of the public. So,
and if you like it, then you can order a larger size.
Of course, yes. And if you like the one from last season, and you want to receive it again, you can do this. And if you want to order more, you can do that as well. There's a portal.
You can still ship your back catalog.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yes, as long as we don't discontinue the fragrance, because we don't have 43 fragrances available in our catalog. We discontinue a scent pretty much every month, so that we keep a reasonable catalog from a supply chain perspective, because you can imagine how many components and ingredients and all of this. That's, you know.
Where's the room where it happens? Where is it put together?
The solutions and the barrels and the actual what we call the juice, so the liquid part, that is all done in New York, mm-hmm. and shipped to us in drums. And then we do the whole assembly and filling and boxing here in
the Wasatch.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. We've had a wonderful conversation with Fabrice Crozet of Sense of Woods. The website is senseofwoods.com. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yes, thank you very much. That was a pleasure.
We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. I misread. I was looking at the wrong website on that last thing. So to get the correct right, said, please go to Sense of Wood Fragrances. I was looking at Scentbird. Sense of Wood Fragrances is where you will find the products of our previous guest, Fabrice. Thanks again.
Thanks, Fabrice. So we often find ourselves stuck in line for something or other. Maybe it's coffee, movie tickets, chairlifts. How about skipping those long lines and still ski? Nordic ski. We're here with Richard Hodges of White Pine Touring to hear about getting out on the tracks. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Indeed. Before we get into the Nordic skiing, let's learn a little bit about you. How long have you been with White Pine?
Okay, I've been with White Pine Touring. This is my sixth season as the Nordic director at White Pine Touring. Prior to that, I did a stint running Soldier Hollow, and I've done various other things in the Nordic business for the last three decades, roughly. But this is my sixth year at White Pine Touring.
Can you give us an overall picture of what White Pine does in the winter? What programs do you offer?
So at White Pine Touring Nordic Center, we're part of the Jans family of retail shops and services. At the Nordic Center, we offer cross-country skiing. We've got trails right outside the door. Almost all of them are open right now, despite the interesting winter weather that we've been having. And we offer snowshoe tours, ski tours, ski lessons, cross-country ski rentals, snowshoe rentals, and at our Bonanza store, we offer fat bike rentals and fat bike tours as well.
So, at which store do you have?
The store on Bonanza Drive.
Right on the rail.
By
trail.
The car wash.
Yeah, and that's the year-round store. We're kind of seasonal.
You turn into a golf shop magically in the spring.
Well, I like to tell the golf shop that we let them use it for golf in the off-season. Their opinion might be a little different, but it's a great, great partnership we have with Park City Municipal. White Pine has been on the golf course for 47 years. In partnership with Park City, and it's extremely unusual anywhere in the continent to have a partnership like that that has lasted that long and worked so well.
And everybody loves it.
Yeah, I call it the community center of Park City.
Yeah.
We have all the locals that have been coming for years. We have new locals. We have, visitors from all over the world coming in, and they mostly just want to come play in the snow. And so we provide the resource. So they can walk right outside the door, get out on the trails, breathe some fresh air, get some exercise, and enjoy themselves in this beautiful community.
Now, we just used the term Nordic skiing. What does that incorporate?
So Nordic skiing broadly includes cross-country skiing, both skate and classic techniques. It includes ski jumping, Nordic combined biathlon. We don't offer any ski jumping or biathlon on the golf course.
Firearms on the golf course.
Not a good choice. But it's the fastest growing winter activity for the last 5 years in the entire world, cross-country skiing. And part of that is accessibility and part of it's affordability. It's an inexpensive way to get the family and friends out and go play in the snow.
Okay, we're going to sort of delve a little bit into the two principal kinds of, as I understand, there are two principal kinds of Nordic cross-country skiing. Can you explain what the two of them are, and we're going to get into how they work?
Yeah, the two basic techniques, and they involve different equipment and different technique, of course, are classic skiing, which is the image you have in your head of somebody striding down the track in that prepared track, kind of similar to running, a more linear kind of skiing. It's beautiful. It's very rhythmic. It can be very meditative out on the course. And it involves using a ski that has a grip section on the bottom of it so that you can propel yourself forward. It's either a fish scale pattern or traditional wax or with the newer skis, a mohair skin that allows you to propel yourself forward in the tracks. And then skate skiing is much more dynamic technique, similar to rollerblading, similar to hockey skating, and using your poles. It's a full body exercise, and it's one of the best, if not the best, aerobic exercise around in the full body movement. And it's a more dynamic technique. It's very popular for fitness skiers, and it has a slightly steeper learning curve than classic skiing.
Oh yeah,
but high reward.
Yeah.
If you come in, get a lesson, get some tips, and then go practice, you can progress pretty quickly in both techniques.
So, yeah, the first technique, the traditional, I take it that if someone just comes to the shop and says, hey, I want to learn how to do this and do it, can they actually make some progress in just one lesson and get onto the track?
It's completely accessible. Getting started is easy. If you want to progress and get better, it takes, like anything else, some application of effort. But if you've come in the door, we can get you out on skis in a very short order, and you can go play on the snow. And you may be going slow, you may be going quickly, but you're outside and almost everybody has a smile on their face when they come back in.
So if I wanted to classic ski, for example, I could go there, rent equipment.
Yep. Walk in the door, rent equipment, purchase a trail pass, and walk outside the door, and 25 feet away, you're on the ski trail.
Any lessons?
We do offer lessons daily. You can book them online. We do have room some days for walk-in lessons, but we encourage people to book online just to fit it into their calendar. But we offer lessons 7 days a week, from beginning at 9 o'clock and going until 1:45 in the afternoon.
So if I wanted to take a lesson, how long would it take me to learn to classic?
So for classic skiing, if you came in, got a lesson, you have 1 hour in the private lesson with your instructor. We don't do large group lessons anymore. We only do private and private group lessons. Come in, you have an hour one-on-one or two-on-one with your instructor. Get all the tips and tricks, and then you can go after that. You're proficient enough to go out and spend the rest of the day out playing.
So, and how many miles of trails?
So right now we have 12 kilometers open. We have 22 kilometers total. The farm trail is not quite open yet. It's been a very interesting challenging. And challenging winter in terms of we've been getting snow, but just not a lot of it. And we've had a lot of warm periods kind of in between those storms. But, you know, luckily we're on the golf course, so we have a very good base on those trails. You know, manicured grass is a great place to start.
Yeah.
Get a few inches of snow on there, pack it down. We're only skiing on the top eighth of an inch, so as long as the subsurface is good, we're out there. We've had our trails open since December 2nd.
Wow.
So,
how do you maintain them? What kind of cool machines get to travel on and do that?
We have all the cool machines. mostly we use a snowmobile and a side-by-side UTV and their various drag implements that we use to kind of set that corduroy and press the classic track in. We're just waiting to get delivery of a leased snowcat this year that we can get out on the farm and do some work on. And then we're looking at purchasing a new one next year. As kind of the business develops. But right now we're going to lease it, but it just needs a little bit more snow to get some of those rocks covered out there.
Seems like that's the mantra of the week here in Park City. We need a little more snow.
Absolutely.
But having said that, it is beautiful out there. The skiing has been amazing out on the trails. It's just, you know, I call the 3-kilometer loop the community trail. You will run into your neighbors, you will run into your friends. Everybody's out there smiling, having a good time. And it's really such a great neighborhood community in the ski community.
Yeah, when I stopped by to see you the other day, I mean, I ran into friends outside. It's a great mixing place.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, the locals and the tourists and everybody is just there to have some fun and kind of get along with each other. And once you're out on the trail, there's no line. It's just beautiful, smooth sailing.
Yeah.
Okay, for our listeners who tune into the 7 o'clock hour here on KPCW, you occasionally talk about colors of wax. And I've heard that any number of times. I have no idea what you're talking about.
it's top secret Nordic stuff. The waxes that we use for both Glide and for the Grip Wax are temperature based. Okay. And so when it's really cold, that would be a blue wax day. And those compounds are basically harder waxes that are more resistant to ice crystals. Today, with the humidity, it's definitely a red wax day, which is kind of that middle range of wax, or purple, depending on the manufacturer. And then as it's slushy, there's a yellow wax that is very water repellent. And it depends on how much you want to glide. If you don't wax your skis and your skis are dried out, it's not going to be a great day. It'll be a good day, but not a great day.
So wax helps
you have a great day.
It sounds like it's a daily maintenance thing. Like every day you sort of look at it.
Well, a good wax job will last a long time. We do a lot of service on skis.
Right.
People drop off their skis and we wax them. If you take good care of your skis, the equipment will last for years, for decades in some cases. But if there's a temperature change, then re-waxing with the new sprays and liquids is actually quite easy. But it definitely improves the smile factor on the trail.
Now, wasn't there some wax that was banned for environmental reasons?
Yes. The fluorocarbon waxes were banned in this community. They've been banned from import into the U.S. They've been banned in the World Cup. And those are the PFAS fluorocarbon compounds. They were high, same kind of similar chemicals to Teflon and Gore-Tex and things like that. We actually have a collection bin that we have had for 3 seasons now, almost 4 seasons, working with the Park City Recycling to collect all those old waxes, get them out of the garages, get them out of the wax box, turn them in, and then we've been offering, you know, some discounts to people for trading in their old waxes to get new non-PFAS waxes out.
Now, how would somebody know that the wax they have in their garage is the bad wax?
Well, it would say fluorinated wax on it. A lot of the higher performance waxes, more expensive waxes, in the past decades have been those fluorinated compounds. All the new waxes have markings on them that they're non-fluorinated. One company has a green snowflake on it, the other one's non, you know. But all the new ones are non-fluoro and, you know, safe to use for the watershed. And getting the older waxes out is huge. There's, you know, the recycling center has a drop-off, and at our shop we have a drop-off.
Okay, so we want to touch on money for a minute. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little about some of the costs associated with cross-country skiing? The lessons, the rentals, and the it's a lift ticket? What do you call it? A trail pass.
A trail pass. So as a customer, if you walk in the door, the daily trail pass is $24.
That's a lot less than a ski pass at one of the resorts.
It's less than lunch. But we have discount, you know, locals can purchase passes early in the year for a season pass, and we have 10 punch passes, so you can lower the cost down pretty significantly, and that gives you access to the trail for the day when you come in. If you're renting, we have, you know, our cross-country classic gear is $35 for the whole day. The skate package is $40 for the whole day. Our lesson packages vary. I mean, the first person lesson is $110 for that hour, and that includes your trail pass and your rental for the day. Snowshoe rentals are $25. It's very accessible for people. From a business cost side, I spend the money on labor and on machinery to groom the trails. we're lucky that we have, as part of the Jans network, a very strong retail presence, and that really helps kind of pay the bills to keep the center open for 52 years.
That's amazing.
I think the Red Banjo might be the only business in town that's still in existence longer than White Pine.
Jeez.
We could have a community competition and find out who's been in business longer.
I expect Tanner to be calling right now.
I know. Yeah. We'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
So the prices are the same whether you're doing the classic cross country or skate ski?
The trail pass is the same. The rental's a little bit more for the skate gear. It's a little bit different, more expensive gear with more supportive boots and the different skis. But
so if someone can downhill ski, they can cross country or skate probably.
They can learn. Yeah, if you're used to gliding, it's pretty accessible. But I mean, we have people come in from all over the world who have never seen snow before, never been on snow before. And it's so much fun.
Yeah.
To get folks website. Out on the snow.
Yeah. And so what is the website people can go to get the reservations?
WhitePineTouring.com.
Outstanding.
Yep. Pretty straightforward. And you can choose lessons. You can get information about all our programs and packages just right there.
Excellent. Richard Hodges from White Pine Touring. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks.
Yep, we'll be right back. Well, we are joined by Emerson Cruz Oliveira. You know his places. If you've been on the town lift, you see the Bridge Cafe right there. Good morning, Emerson. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So I'm going to jump into it real quick. I know it's the Bridge.
Bridge.
Below the bridge is Flying
Sumo.
Yep. Yes. And what's your other business?
It's a cleaning company for the nightly rentals in town. So we do some cleaning business and out there.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you are in business with your wife, Juliana Klein.
Juliana Klein is my wife. We do this together.
Excellent. I'm sorry she couldn't be here with us today.
She said hello. So hello to everyone.
So let's talk about how you got here. Tell us a little bit about your background in the restaurant business and sort of what led you to opening these businesses, and when did you open them?
Oh, originally from Brazil. So I came here as a student, a J1 student at the time, about 23 years ago, say that, kind of, you know, losing account. I actually graduated in Brazil in computer science. And
as far as clear path to restaurant ownership.
Well, yes, nothing related to it, but so in my last year over there, I came to do the program, and it worked at Deer Valley for the season. So there was no introduction to the restaurant at that time. That came a few years later when I started working at a restaurant and started knowing and liking and enjoying a little more and more. And my background in computers actually helped me out to get into the everything about the restaurants, because I stopped doing the softwares that they use it nowadays for, you know, for taking orders and whatnot. So I used to study that, and I studied more here, and then there was everything related to the restaurant, so I had to learn everything around. And I worked in all positions in the restaurant, so that kind of brought me into the world of the restaurant business.
And which was the first restaurant you opened?
The Bridge Cafe and Grill, as far as opening, was the first one. I worked for the Sweeney Brothers back in the day when the restaurant was called Town Lift Cafe. Mm-hmm. They hold it for a couple of years, I guess, and that didn't go well. And so they leased the space out to some other ones. But then that's when I met them and I worked for them at the time. And a few years later, I got an invitation from Mike Sweeney to talk and perhaps open up my own thing. He was, you know, following my work all around, and that's when everything started. So I got together with a couple friends at the time, and we put the Bridge Cafe and Grill together, and then my wife came up with the name. We were right there, and then we worked for 4 months of the season at the time. It was 2008. And we at the very end of the season, looks like we we got to a conclusion that the business wasn't for us. we kind of like you know, looks like we failed on this mission. So then the two friends that I had, or still friends, don't get me wrong on that. They decided to go to a different path, and then I stayed here with my wife. And then you know, we looked at each other and said, "What we do?" We decided to keep going. So from that point on, it's, you know, 16, almost 17 years in the run, and still running. So,
and it's now open year round.
It is open year round. Yeah, okay. we take a break here and there as far as shutting down for you know, clean up and what's not, and give a break to everyone around it. But yeah, year round.
For those who haven't had the opportunity to eat their lunch at the Bridge Cafe after a morning of skiing, Tell us a little bit about your menus and what meals do you serve?
Well, the focus, we are a breakfast place for sure, breakfast and lunch. We used to be open all day and have dinner, but then we make business decisions and we decided to focus on what we are good at and what's more profitable for sure. And then breakfast and lunch, it's all we got. And our menu, it's a mix of a little bit of our Brazilian influence on that. A few additions. We used to have more, gotta say that, but then we need to focus on business as well, so we change a little bit, but we still have the core, and we still have the vibe, you know? I mean, we employ all the students like me, it was back in the day, they're J1s, and they come from South America, and they come from Europe in the summer, and then we have the vibe and then that culture, and I think that's what makes us successful.
Agreed. I love going there.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
And so that's the first restaurant. The second restaurant is.
So the second one is Flying Sumo. So a few years after the Bridge, I gotta say that the first 3 or 4 years at the Bridge was really hard. I mean, we had to put a lot of work. We still do put a lot of work, but things was not that great at the time. It took us a little while to, you know, but then a few years after that, I actually opened the cleaning company first. And then with that, we got a boost to, you know, open more doors. And then the Flying Sumo came available, and then we took the chances on that as well.
Was that an existing restaurant that you bought?
Flying Sumo was an existing restaurant. It was there, if we put it all the days together, I think we're talking about 28 years to 29 right now. We took over about 12 years ago, so.
I don't know much about the restaurant business, but I do know that a sushi place has a very different set of ingredients. How do you learn how to manage a sushi place? I mean, I get the Brazilian stuff. I mean, but tell us a little bit about that process.
Right. Well, the sushi place is all about opportunity. And then when that came up, and, you know, I had no doubts. It's just like, you got to go for it. My godfather is Japanese. And then there was that influence. So actually, when I grew up in Brazil in certain places, where I'm from, we got the second biggest Japanese culture in Brazil, and then I kind of grew up around that, and I was always a big fan. In fact, one of my biggest dreams is to go to Japan, and I never did, but it looks like I think this summer we're going to realize that. And then became my wife's dream and my kids' dream, so we're going to go visit Japan. But I think that influence when I was a kid and have my godfather with the heritage, and I think that helped me out, you know. And other than that, I had to count, and I still count, and my crew, and I still counted my chefs, and they are there, and then they knew that, they knew how to perform, and sushi is an art.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different scenario, as you just mentioned. But it's fascinating.
Have you learned how to do it yourself?
I actually did. I gotta say, I'm not good. You know, I'm gonna be honest with that. But being in a restaurant, you gotta be able to do everything around
right.
it. You know,
yeah.
You gotta be able to jump in and don't be afraid. Make it happen because you know you need to. Your crew is counting on you to show them that you have the knowledge and then you're capable to do it. So I can do it, but. Don't count and be good, so.
Now, how hard is it to find a sushi chef? If you lose a sushi chef.
It is really hard. In fact, a few years ago, we went through a tough time. My head chef, he has been doing this for more than 25 years. He decided to take a break and, you know, retired. And then that was a big impact in the business. I gotta be honest with that. So we had try to hire different chefs, and which is super hard to get it. So the restaurant went through a tough time, but I was able to turn around with a different program. And now we train everyone in house. So it doesn't matter if you want to stop by, Roger, and you know, start learning. If I work over there, we'll take you and we train you, and you know, we'll bring you to be part of the family. So.
In addition to sort of the trickiness of the actual making of the sushi, I would guess that the sourcing of ingredients, which, you know, is also a bit of a challenge, particularly the need to have that fish be so fresh.
It is. Nowadays, I mean, I've seen the changes. Nowadays, it's the logistics got way better. We got a couple of different companies, suppliers, that provide that fish to us, and then the logistics is pretty impressive. Stuff that we buy comes from Japan. And then they have this time lead and everything is shipped overnight. Of course, the overnight from Japan to U.S. takes more than just overnight. But it's the logistics is pretty impressive, and we are able to get that in here. And people always say, it's like, well, but you're in the middle of the mountain. How do you get that stuff? It's like, well, you know, logistics nowadays, it got pretty streamlined, and they're fast, and that's how we get it.
Now, going back to computer science, did you ever think you would own a restaurant, or did you expect to own a software company that does point of sale?
Yeah, it's if I have to bring back a memory, it's a tough one.
Sorry.
But I think what I can take from that time when I was in Brazil, I always had that feeling in that I did not want to work behind a desk. Don't get me wrong, anyone out there. I just had that feeling that to go out and explore all the mm-hmm. time. So I think, you know, from the computer science, the knowledge that I got helped me out to get into the business over here in a certain way. But I think it was more of this outgoing and trying to experience everything out there that I could be moving all the time. And then the restaurant business gets me moving all the time. it's a nonstop. And my wife and I, we are nonstop. And that's what I think. That's what got me into the, you know, this whole restaurant business and being an entrepreneur and being a restaurateur nowadays.
So. Emerson, if I walk down Main Street today and then I think about what it looked like 5 years ago, most of the names on those restaurants are different.
Yes,
but
and I've seen
not.
That.
What do you attribute your ability to keep, you know, to have a long life in these businesses? Well, what are you doing right that other people are missing?
I think if you really need to put something like that, what we're doing right, I think we are working. We really put our passion and our work ethic into the business, and we're trying to be as friendly as we can, and we're trying to be as strict as we can, and we're trying to show our employees that, you know, all the hard work we put in is always paid off someday. And I think that's what we have into our place, that our employees understand that. And I think the culture that we bring it in, you know, being from Brazil and all that, I think that's part of that. The vibrancy, again, that's part of that. And I think if you combine all that and put everything you got into the business itself, I think you'll be successful.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. Can you quickly share with us the web addresses for Flying
Yes, www.thebridgecafeandgrill.com and www.flyingsumosushi.com.
Gotcha. And before we leave, do you have a motto, a business motto, or some kind of rule that guides you and guides your employees?
We learned along the way. At the beginning, I cannot say that I knew everything about business and how to run a restaurant, you know. So there was a lot of, we had to put an effort in and learning along the way. And I think we learned the right things and we learned of our mistakes. So our motto is put everything you got, work hard, and then you can be successful. I think that's the motto.
Thank you very much.